Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonpartisan nonprofit organization. I'm Lindsay Langholz, Senior Director of Policy and Program. Here at ACS, we're preparing for our annual convention. For those of you who might be unfamiliar, this is our biggest gathering of the year, where we bring together lawyers, law students, scholars, judges, activists, and policymakers to examine some of the most urgent and challenging issues confronting our nation. As we pull together our programming for this year, two speeches from last year's convention keep ringing in my ears. Both focus on what lawyers contribute to our legal system, good and bad, and the special responsibility we have to meet this moment. Here on Broken Law, we like to say that we speak about whose interests our legal system serves and whose it does not. These two speeches point out that the legal system is not a faceless structure, but rather created and maintained by people, and highlights the active participation of lawyers in that process. We want to bring shortened versions of both of these speeches to those who couldn't join us last year, and also take this opportunity to encourage you to come down to Atlanta, June 6th through 8th, for this year's convention, if you're able. We'll include a registration link in the show notes, but for now, please enjoy these two incredible speeches. First, you'll hear from Oren Nimney, litigation director at Rights Behind Bars. He'll be followed by Sherilyn Eiffel, former president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and current Vernon E. Jordan Jr. Esquire Endowed Chair in Civil Rights at Howard University.
Fair warning before I dive in, I'm a lawyer for people in prisons, facing unspeakable abuses, and in litigating prison cases, we fight against some of the highest explicit and implicit barriers in the legal system. Rules and norms established to keep people in prison out of the courts and out of the light. So this might be a bit depressing, but I also promise that I'll bring some hope as well. When I talk to some of my family about what I do, they always have two questions. First, they ask if I'm aware that there are some lawyers that work places where they make a lot of money, and question why I work somewhere called a nonprofit. Then they ask a more fundamental question. What is it that you do again? And so I say, I'm a lawyer, and I sue prisons. And those are the things that I want to talk about today. Prisons, how they exist and function in the current system, and what I've learned over a decade of working with people inside, and lawyers and the role that we play in building and continuing the current incarceration crisis that's plaguing communities across the country. Even after so many years working with clients in prisons, I still find it difficult to convey what it means to be in a prison. For our clients, it means a change to almost every aspect of their lives. They're stripped of their freedom and everything that that word entails. They often lose their homes, their jobs, their cars, their pets. Often they lose their family as well, whether through formal termination of parental rights or through the myriad ways that prisons cut off communication between spouses and partners, parents and children, often forcing people to go decades without an in-person visit, let alone a hug or dinner with family. Inside, people are subjected to what can only be and has been defined as torture. The abuses we see at Rights Behind Bars run the gamut. From Mr. Taylor, who was forced to lie naked in a putrid feces-covered cell for 6 days, or Mr. An, who was placed in solitary confinement in a private immigration detention facility and allowed to die by suicide, or the hundreds of people who are denied available medical care every single day, or Mr. Durham, who simply wanted a cane so that he could walk around his New Jersey facility and was told, no, you don't get a cane because you're too annoying. This isn't even to mention the labor that people in prisons have forced upon them without consent and without pay. Slavery in both name and definition. We have clients in Missouri forced to make furniture and bedding, in Louisiana forced to pick okra in the hot sun, and in Massachusetts forced to make license plates for the cars that drive by their facility every single day. Every day doing this job is learning about a new indignity, like the fact that prisons and jails charge people rent for the privilege of being forcibly incarcerated there, or that Virginia still uses attack dogs in its DOC facilities, or that in St. Louis, now that the jail where guards staged gladiator fights is closed, our clients are forced into the jail where they're indiscriminately maced and deprived of water as punishment. It's learning about people like our client, Miss Edwards, who was pregnant in a North Carolina facility and shackled while in labor, and then taken off of necessary medication postpartum because there was no longer concern for the fetus, just for her. And it's learning about the women in FCI Dublin, dozens of whom have been sexually assaulted by federal guards and yet are still denied even things like compassionate release or available immigration relief from this administration's Bureau of Prisons and Department of Justice. The central thing here is that these cases actually aren't unique. Abuses like this happen every single day in prisons and jails across the country. They are commonplace. We could have 1,000 attorneys at Rights Behind Bars and still not be able to litigate every case that comes in the door. And that, the sheer regularity of it all, is perhaps the most troubling thing. Now, of course, there are bright spots. The work couldn't be done without them. Human beings find so many ways to thrive in even the harshest conditions. For me, I've been able to develop meaningful, long-lasting relationships with people inside. We've laughed and cried. We've built trust and fought back against injustices big and small. We've won amazing victories against the longest odds. Because if there's one good thing about repression, it's that it breeds resistance. Dostoevsky wrote that the degree of civilization in a society can be judged by entering its prisons. Unfortunately, over my time working with people in jails, prisons, and immigration detention facilities, I've come to the unavoidable conclusion that we've constructed a horror that's immoral at its core, and that the stain of our prison system has made our whole society worse off. To me, this conclusion is inescapable for any observer of our prison system. The response is that, of course, prisons are bad, very bad maybe, and we should curb some of the worst abuses, but we need prisons. Prisons keep us safe. But unfortunately, this too isn't true. Even if you didn't think that prisons, the abuses I described as inherent to the prison system, were immoral, it should be very troubling that we're doing all of this in the name of security, but receiving none. There's little evidence that prisons make us safer, and in fact, everything points to the opposite conclusion. The United States incarcerates more people than any nation in the world. We spend the most money on prisons, hundreds of billions of dollars. You would think, as a result, we would be the safest country in the world, but we aren't. And it's no mystery why. We all agree we need a safe society, but we continue to invest in solutions that exacerbate the problem, and it's quite literally killing us. A recent Prison Policy Institute report demonstrated that a year in prison takes 2 years off of a person's life expectancy, and that as a result of the sheer number of people we incarcerate, the United States' average life expectancy has dropped dramatically. All this is particularly strange when we know the things that do create safety. Things like education, housing, mental and physical health services, access to good food and clean water, meaningful community connections. But instead, rather than dealing with those problems head-on and investing in those solutions, we choose to warehouse people in prisons that not only do not address real security concerns, but actually create violence. Prisons are often violent places. It's just violence we can't see. It doesn't make the news. And there's the violence that prisons create for people when they get out. People are subjected to extreme trauma and then shuffled out with limitations to their housing and their job prospects and expected to manage the mental health issues often gifted them by prisons. Prisons do not help rehabilitate people. They're not designed for that. Anyone who's been in a prison can tell you as a practical matter, people can't heal there. Instead, prisons are there to punish. They're the punishment we've devised for poverty, for race, for nonconformity, and for disability. Just ask our clients. Just ask our clients, like Mr. Folks, who was charged with a felony, because he had mental health issues that caused him to harm himself one day in a Louisiana parish jail. You heard that right. He was charged with a felony. In Louisiana, it's a felony to harm yourself in a jail or prison. It's called felony self-mutilation of a prisoner. And while not every state makes that a crime, every Department of Correction punishes such manifestations of mental health issues with some form of prison discipline. Prisons, as a result, prevent healing and ensure violence. They sap resources from better-equipped alternatives. The question, then, is, if prisons are so bad, if they're so harmful to the people inside and their families, and so bad at doing what they're nominally designed for, how did we get here? How have we built a prison system that is larger and more costly than any in the world? One troubling answer has emerged to me time and time again over the course of learning about prisons, representing clients, and advocating for change. The answer, unfortunately, is us, lawyers. Lawyers have built the foundation and structure that populates, maintains, and protects the American prison system. It is lawyers who every single day in courtrooms across America ask judges to confine people in jail pre-trial and then to imprison them for decades. It is lawyers who wrote the statutes determining why one thing should be criminalized and one thing should not. It's lawyers who wrote statutes like the Prison Litigation Reform Act, which determined that, in the name of docket control, People in prison should be systematically barred from using the courts like everyone else. It's lawyers who every day defend the prisons, jails, and immigration detention centers who commit the atrocities that I spoke about just a second ago. Every time a guard assaults someone or a prison denies a mobility-impaired person a cane, there's a lawyer there saying, it wasn't that bad. And even if it was, that person shouldn't be able to sue for it. It's impossible to capture for people who do not see it every day, but the aggregate of all of these words from all of these lawyers is this. Untold injustices continue to happen every day, and a system no reasonable human could begin to justify is called justice. Now you might say, this is how our system works. It's just how it is. But lawyers, just like any other profession, are responsible for what we do. Perhaps more so because of the power that we wield. We are responsible for the justice of the causes we choose to champion. Systems don't arise out of nothing. They're built every day on every decision we make, and no decision is neutral. The aggregate decisions of the legal profession up to this point have tacked strongly one way, in favor of staggering harm, in favor of punishment over empathy, prisons over people. But, and here's the hope I promised, it doesn't need to be that way. Just as we've been the architects of this system, we can be the architects of building a better world. That's what so many people in this room do every single day. They fight with their clients to eke a little more justice out of the world. And it's that lead that we should all follow, organize together in service of building something better rather than tinkering around the edges of something that's never worked. By and large, lawyers aren't treating the horrors of prisons as an emergency. We aren't organizing against it, but we can. We can come together in every office and every courtroom and state legislators and in Congress and press on this as the emergency that it is. We can do vital work to inform the public of the gap between our ideals and our realities. At Rights Behind Bars, we have a particular way of doing our work. We've seen the great work that's come before us from people like David Carliner and some of the places that we've come up short. And we want to forge a new path with familiar tools. Our work puts a premium on ensuring that it is a just world that we are building. To that end, we lawyer with social movements, inside and out, who are seeking to create a safe and just society. At its core, this type of lawyering, what we now call movement lawyering, is concerned with power. Who has it and who doesn't? And for our work, shifting power to movements fighting against our prisons, jails, and immigration detention centers. We view law as only one tool to assist in this fight. And this is vital, because change often comes only from a confluence of pressures, inside and outside of courts, building up to something more. We can't view law as the only vehicle for social change, because it is and it always has been social movements that lead the way.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now, back to the conversation.
The first thing I want to do is start with something hopeful, which is one of the great things about having been in this work for a long time, is that you get to see the arc of the work, and you know that by and large, regardless of how it looks, we have been incredibly successful. Now, it may not feel that way, especially to people who haven't seen the arc, but, you know, Justin, I taught one of the first environmental justice clinics in the country at law school. The second clinic I taught was the second clinic in the country to address barriers facing formerly incarcerated people, ORIN. And right before I left law teaching to join LDF, the last clinic I started was a reparations clinic. Each of these things seemed crazy at the time that I was doing them. And yet those conversations are now at the center of the table. And I think we have to recognize that the moment that we're in is a perilous one. It's one we've been driven to, however, not because of what we have not done, but because our opponents are responding to what we've done. The effort to stop children from reading books, about the struggles of race or LGBTQ people or women or poor people or immigrants, it's not because they were winning. It's because we had moved those conversations to the center of our families' lives, because those books were in every library, because teachers were teaching this. And their response is the backlash. And the reason I worry about this is because if we don't properly diagnose the problem and recognize that they are responding to us, we will stop doing the things that we do that are successful. Voter suppression bills. Why is there a voter suppression bill that says you can't give refreshments to people standing online to vote? That is because Black voters stood online for 9 hours in Fulton County, Georgia. It's a response to what we have done. Now, I don't mean to suggest that doing what we did in the past is all we have to do. But what I am suggesting is let's make sure we don't drop too much luggage on the path towards what we have to do to face this moment. We have to keep voting. We have to keep advocating and keeping our arms linked with the immigrant community, the LGBTQ community. We have to stand up for teachers. We have to stand up for librarians. Those are our people. Those are our people. But I want to speak to this room with great respect to all of the organizers and politicians who may be here. I want to talk to the lawyers for a minute. Because, as has already been suggested by Oren, we bear a special responsibility from the system from which we earn our living, from which we earn our prestige, from which we earn our paychecks. And we are rightfully complicit in a system that regularly churns out injustice. We are complicit in a system that, in Baltimore, will prosecute someone who is alleged to be a gang leader for witness tampering or obstruction of justice. But when political figures at the highest level of government send messages saying, you know he reads the transcripts, we all pretend we don't understand what that means. We have to take hold of this system to which we have pledged our lives. We took an oath, and at least for me, oaths matter. And this system is not worthy at this moment of the oaths that we have taken. The chickens have come home to roost, and some of the most nefarious people are taking advantage of the gaps that were already in our system. Trump didn't create an unequal legal system in this country. Bill Barr didn't create an unequal legal system in this country. No, that existed already. And while many of us have been fighting it as a profession, we have to demand that our profession stand up and speak with one voice. In my purse is my pocket constitution. It doesn't have a cover on it anymore. It's very worn. And sometimes I'm embarrassed that, you know, I switch it from one purse to the other. Like, why are you still carrying this? I started carrying it in 1997, the first time I went to South Africa while they were in the truth and reconciliation process, and everyone had a pocket constitution. And I thought, that is incredibly cool. And I started carrying it. And then I couldn't let it go, mostly because I wanted to be able to quickly counter in arguments with folks that I might engage with. And I'm constantly asking myself why I'm carrying it. And I will share with you that I'm carrying it now because, again, the Constitution is unfinished business for us as lawyers. If we are honest with ourselves, we have not used what Tom Sayens calls the whole Constitution. We have allowed ourselves to be mesmerized by the terms of the debate and the contest set by those on the conservative side. We run down rabbit holes that they create, and we attach legitimacy to ideas that they simply created so that they could gain power. But we meet it like it's real, and we try to really figure it out and make those, I've done it, and make arguments that we think will appeal to that particular idea. We've done it with judicial confirmations, with balls and strikes and stripping down like a runner and all of this foolishness. And it has allowed us to become distracted from what we needed to do. The result is we have wasted precious time and we are now at the precipice. Here's the good news. For the first time in my professional life, I believe we are at the moment in this country when we have no choice but to create the America that I believe most of the people in this room have always wanted. It is not the one that existed in 2008 or 1997. I've been a civil rights lawyer for 30 years, never been out of work, so obviously it wasn't perfect. When we see people being released from jail after serving 30 years in prison for a crime they didn't commit, that's a sign it's been bad for a while. These prison conditions didn't just start. So this has been going on for a while, and now we've been herded to the point where we have no choice but to confront it and deal with it. And for me, I'm not going to pretend that I'm not excited about that. I'm not going to pretend that what I want is to return to 2010 and to glorify the systems that I've spent 30 years fighting against. This is our opportunity to create what we really want. And the good news for us is that we have examples in the past that America can be made and remade again. It happened during the civil rights movement. It may not have been perfect, but I can tell you this room would not look like this room without it. You would probably not be living where you are living. And here I'm not just talking to the Black people now. Were it not for the work of the civil rights movement, were it not for the work in the courts of LDF and other civil rights organizations, you would not be married to who you're married to, perhaps. You would not have gone to the schools that you went to. Perhaps your children would not, and you would not have been able to get the jobs that you were able to get. Hell, we once did a study, you wouldn't be able to drink coffee in the airport coffee shop, some of you, us. So we understand that it can happen. And those people didn't know what the outcome was going to be either. They had no guarantees. They had no reason to believe that they would succeed in breaking the back of Jim Crow. And yet they stepped forward anyway, and they sacrificed and they strategized. And to Justin's point, when they had conflicts with the movement, you didn't hear about it publicly. They did what they had to do and got what they could get. And if we are inclined to criticize them at this moment for not getting the whole thing, just remember they got enough for you to be here. And so our job is to get enough for that next generation, to decide that we will not tolerate, we will not pass along a world in which girls and women don't have control of their bodies. We will not pass along a world in which citizens are not able to vote and participate in the process. We will not allow the prison walls to hide the most grotesque human rights abuses that are undertaken in our name. We will not allow ourselves to have a judiciary that lacks integrity and that allows the kind of excesses that we have seen. We will not allow 90% of people facing eviction to have no legal counsel. We will not allow all of the issues related to access to justice and affordable housing. We will not acquiesce to language that suggests that the answer to homelessness is vigilante murder on a subway. We will not keep our children from reading some of our most powerful, moving writers who reach down into their souls and into our experiences and into our ancestors to help us understand who we are and how we navigate in this world. But to do that, I don't hear you. And when I say you, I mean our profession. I see the excesses happen, but I don't see the immediate response from the institutions of our profession. And we have to make that happen. We're responsible. We are lawyers. We are in a profession, And that means that whether we like each other or not, we are all united in a system that by our very participation in it, we are suggesting is legitimate. If it's not legitimate, then we need to own up to it or speak out and work to change it. So for the people in this room, I want you to feel this moment is one that is precarious. I do not think it is a guarantee that we make it out of this a democracy. But I believe we will. But remember, if we do, as I told students at NYU Law School this morning, we have been, certainly for my whole lifetime and probably for the lifetime of every person in this room, an unhealthy democracy. Our goal has to be higher, bigger, more ambitious. Now we have the chance, because so many systems are unraveling, because people who thought they knew it all, who had all the op-eds and all the papers and were regarded as the experts, turned out to be wrong about our country. And my little old clients in Alabama and Mississippi, they were right. They were right. So now let's be courageous enough and honest enough to admit that we too, perhaps, listened to the wrong voices, that we too have bowed before so-called experts, and recognize that we are responsible now for not just returning ourselves to hanging on to democracy by our fingernails, but to creating a healthy, sound democracy of integrity that benefits all her people. That's the task before us. And if we're going to do that, we're going to have to do two things I know. We're going to have to break some eggs, which means some things going to have to go. I mean, you, filibuster and all this stuff, they're going to have to go. And I appreciate the fears about what the other side may do. That is no way to win a war. You want to think tactically about what they may do, but that can't strangle you from being bold. So it's time for institutional reform, reform within our profession, Senate reform, House reform, executive branch reform. If we are to come out of this, it may be our one last chance in this modern era to create a new America. So we got to break some eggs. The second thing we have to do, and my fellow progressive people, this is something we just wrestle with, we have to be unequivocal, unafraid, and unabashed about seeking power. Now, I understand this may be, you know, a remnant. I grew up in the 70s and power, the man, and all that. But listen, you cannot cower to the people. You cannot make transformative change without power. And we have to start speaking in those terms within the democratic process. And I would say this to my partisan friends. Some of you here work within one of the political parties. I think there's actually only one political party at this point. The other one is doing something else. But working with, even within a party structure, that party has to speak about power. We have to speak as civil rights activists and lawyers about power. The Constitution is a document that identifies how to manage, obtain, and responsibly use power. And it includes within it a recognition of how to deal with abuses of power. And half the time, we're too frightened to use it. So for the next year, I'm entering a planning process to create a project on the 14th Amendment, which I believe is the one provision of the Constitution that most honestly and powerfully articulates the vision for this new country that was created after the Civil War. It includes provisions that I'm sure you know about, but that you very often don't talk about, and that many of our people don't talk about. The person with the AR-15 on their back buying a Big Mac will tell you that it is his Second Amendment right. But when was the last time you heard someone say their 14th Amendment rights were violated? I mean, just a normal person in the McDonald's. We talk about bias and discrimination and bigotry. We don't ground it in our constitutional rights, and therefore it ends up in the conversation about feelings and whether you have a racist bone in your body and whether you see race, none of which is what it's about. It is about the framers of the Civil War amendments creating a reset in this country. That reset was derailed by white violence, by Congress's inaction for 70 years and by the Supreme Court. But it's there in the amendment. And I'll be sharing more about that over the next 6 months. I know we need lots of new things, but we are leaving tools sitting right here that were created precisely for us. When those framers of the 14th Amendment said that those who participated in insurrection cannot serve in state or federal government, it's because these people knew. They knew these insurrectionists were crazy and weren't going to stop. And we know that provision exists, and yet we take no action. Even in so-called blue states, many of us had people who participated on January 6th. We don't use the power. We have power in the 14th Amendment to address the debt crisis, and we treat it like it's the nuclear option. It's constitutional. It's right there. It's right there. Now, I don't mean to pretend that, you know, I don't recognize that the courts are a little iffy right now, and so we have to be very, very careful. I'm not saying that. And I'm not saying that I'm just looking for new legal strategies. I do think we have an opportunity to reset our national identity and the set of commitments around which we identify ourselves as a democracy. I want us to be that ambitious. I want us just not to win a case. I want us not to just elect someone to office. I want us to reimagine this country in the way that I think so many of us have wanted. And I honestly believe that if we are not that ambitious, if we are not prepared to do a full reset, we will be back here. Even if we make it out of this period as a limping democracy, we will be back here in 10 years. If we really want to make change, and many of us have in this room have been around long enough to know that we haven't made the kind of transformative change we want to, this is the time. And for that reason, even though I'm as exhausted as you are and I'm angry and pissed off, I'm excited. I am excited about this moment when we have the opportunity to become founders of a new America.
Thanks to our listeners for finding Broken Law. Please be sure to follow and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. If you're enjoying this show, help us bring it to more listeners by giving us a 5-star review and recommending Broken Law to a friend. If you have ideas for future episodes, please let us know. We really want to hear them. You can email us at podcast@acslaw.org or find us on social media @ACSLaw. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interest it really serves, and whose it does not.